Hello and welcome to Recovery Internet Radio, broadcasting live and direct from Straight Stuff Studios. It's hot, it's muggy, the mosquitoes are out, but you know, we're staying cool here, so thanks for joining us tonight. If you're a regular listener of the show, I was a little off on our count, but this is officially show number 70, folks, 70, ladies and gentlemen.
All right.
Thanks for being with us. We're happy to have you here. I'd like to just, you know, take a quick minute to, I don't want to say sponsors, but friends of the show, and just say a couple of quick words about some of our friends here. If you went to see Double Take, the band, they played a show, I believe, just last night. You know, summertime, great time to go see a concert. They were in Glendale Heights, but they'll be playing again in Mount Prospect Saturday, August 10th at 9 o'clock. So check them out. They're at doubletakechicago.com.
Where are they playing, does it say?
El Sombrero Restaurant and Lounge.
Okay.
And where?
In Mount Prospect, Illinois. So go check them out. You know, is there a band
Spanish with a Russian accent?
I like to mix it up a little bit. I got a diverse background. So check them out. Go see Double Take. They do great cover music from the 50s till today or something along those lines.
Yeah,
check out their website. Let's see. We also are affiliated with a mentoring program, Sidekicks Mentoring. It is a youth mentoring program. It's a no-cost volunteer program designed to offer structure and support for maintaining a healthy and sober lifestyle. We're not exactly big brother and big sisters, but you know, you get the idea.
And we're going to be in the Fiesta Day Parade.
Oh, can I
next
do the
Sunday
Spanish accent again? Fiesta Day Parade in McHenry, Illinois. That is Sunday, the 21st.
Seems like it.
Yeah.
Is this today the 14th?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're not allowed to throw candy, but we'll hand you a sucker.
Right.
So come and check us out there.
Right.
Check back on our website, which is recoveryinternetradio.com, conveniently named. We've just added some new links. One in particular is from drugdangers.com. We try to have plenty of material out there to, you know, get you to where you need to go. So if you're out there listening to this show and you say, hey, that sounds like maybe something I'd be interested in learning more about, we'd like to get you linked up. There's links to lots of programs on there. So check our links page, and there's a ton of great information and good organizations that we support. Also, last but not least, we'd like to say a little bit about our host here, Mr. Rick Atwater. If you've been listening, you know him. You know him, you love him.
Go Rick.
Yeah. In addition to his, you know, his famous career here on live radio, he also writes a newspaper article in the Northwest Herald. He's out there every Sunday. Well, I mean, his article. He's not physically out there, but his article. check out the style section on Sundays in the Northwest Herald. Pick it up if you're reading the Sunday paper. It's called Straight Talk. He's been doing it for some time. You can go to northwestherald.com and see, you know, the last 5-6 archived articles that he has written. But it's in the same, it's in the similar vein. You might notice a trend with Rick. So that's
the subject.
The subject matter is along the same line. So if you get a kick out of the show and you're in the vicinity to pick up a Herald, it's a local paper, or in the Northwest suburbs here, check it out. And I think that's all I got. Is that enough?
Yeah, I think that'll hold us. And I wanted to mention, let's see if I can get this right. We just connected with a friend of ours, Mr. Pat Perez, our local PGA golfing champ guy, and on Twitter at Pat Perez Golf. So we are now following Pat, and hopefully
he has like maybe a couple more followers than we do.
Yeah, like we have like 8,000 or something, or 3,000.
Yeah, yeah. So if you haven't followed us yet on Twitter, it's at Rick Atwater.
Yeah.
So you can follow us, you know.
Yeah, okay. So that's the sum total of my stuff for tonight. And so I just want to welcome everybody. And got a rowdy crowd here tonight. And always love that. Our tag tonight is Meet the Amazing Chocolate Easter Bunny. And you'll find out about that in a minute. Our guest is Barb. So thanks for joining us this Sunday night, where we are every Sunday night at 8 o'clock. except when we pre-record and then we're somewhere else. But the show is always at Sunday night at 8 o'clock, thanks to Chris, our engineer. You can call the show. Big hand for Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
My pleasure.
You can call into the show at 323-792-2977. That's 323-792-2977. If you have questions or comments, or if you're like a lot of people in this room, opinions. You can also tweet us at Rick Atwater, and that we can pick up your tweet live and respond to you that way. And also remember to check out recoveryinternetradio.com. That's
recoveryinternetradio.com
for all our archive shows and recovery resources. And I think with that, we'll rock and roll. What do you think?
We're off.
We're off and running. So, okay. So, the first thing is we got to get this chocolate Easter bunny thing cleared up. So, can we talk about that a little bit first?
Sure.
Okay. Where did that come from?
Chocolate Easter bunny. When I went to my first effective Al-Anon encounter, I looked good on the outside. And just like a chocolate Easter bunny, you know, they're all shiny and put together, and you look at it and go, oh, how pretty or how cute. Doesn't that look delicious? But absolutely hollow on the inside. And that's how I felt. No one would ever know it. You know, I looked like I had a great job. I was married. I lived in a great area. Blah, 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 blah. And on the inside, I was empty.
And there we have it, the chocolate Easter bunny.
That's the chocolate Easter bunny.
That's a great analogy. I knew when you told me that when we were talking, I knew immediately what you were talking about. But for the sake of our listeners, we got to say what it is. So say a little bit about what your upbringing was like and how that prepared you for your experiences to come, or it didn't prepare you for your experiences to come.
I shouldn't say that. The first 10 years of my life were fabulous. I had a mother, and I had a father, and a sister, and a brother.
Were you from around here, or where were you from?
I was born in Ohio.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And I was the notorious middle child, and I was described as precocious, and I adored my dad, adored my father. My mom and I never quite saw eye to eye, but in hindsight, I was a handful. I was a very precocious little girl and very strong-willed, and the sun rise and set on my dad. And at the age of 10, my dad went away in February. He went to a hospital. And my younger brother was 5, my sister was 13, and I was 10 years old. Went away in February, and he died in June. And from February till June, we never saw him. We never spoke about him. We were led to believe, I'll never forget being at church one day, and two men, a choir director and another man, looked at me, his little 10-year-old, and said, well, how's your dad doing, Barb? And I said, oh, he's getting better. He's going to come home. And they looked at each other, and they shook their head no. And as a 10-year-old, I knew.
You remember them doing that?
So oh,
you
knew what that so meant. Vividly. I knew exactly what that meant. And my mom and I never really saw eye to eye. I was a bedwetter, and I was skinny, and I was not coordinated. And my older sister was pretty darn perfect. And my younger brother was a male. And because he was a male and carrying on the family name, oh, hello. And I was kind of there in the middle. And I remember being a little girl and in first grade, my hair got in my way. So I lifted up a desk and I took scissors and cut my hair off down to the scalp. That was a nice look. Okay.
Kind of funky for the time.
For a goth, yeah. You know, it would be a nice look. But back in the 60s, it was not so
hot. Not so much.
No, no. And I remember coming home and my mother looking at me and going, just the shame. Every time I did something was shame. Just wait until your father gets home. Wait until you see what he thinks. And it was just, that's how I grew up. And then when I was 10 and he died, there's a family picture right before he died, and it showed my dad with both of his hands on my shoulders, and my mom with one arm around my sister and the other arm around my brother. And a picture is worth a thousand words.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have that on my dresser today, and I will always have it. After he died, his sister sent us tickets to go to California because that's where she lived. And so after the funeral, we flew to California.
Were you shocked when he died, or did you know that was coming by that time?
Oh, I was absolutely shocked. The day that he died, shocked. I knew it was coming. I didn't want it to be true. We never talked about it. He died. His sister was there. My oldest sister was told to go to school that day. It was in June, and she had a test to take. And I was told that I had to go sell Girl Scout flipping cookies because, you know, life goes on. And it's like, okay, fine, he's dead. Here we go. And life just went on as if he never died,
so,
as if he was never there to begin with.
One of the other things we were talking about just before the show was about one of the questions is about, what tools did you have, or were the tools for life that you had adequate to the task? And you were kind of laughing that. So this kind of brings us to that question a little bit. So
the day he died was the day that the person I could have become died.
So can you say a little more about that?
Time stopped. My life stopped.
Hmm.
I had no tools. We couldn't grieve. It was just very, very surreal. And I went in this little... it wasn't just surreal. I remember one little girl saying, when I was forced to go sell these cookies downtown, and one of the girls, her name was, well, I'm not going to say her name, I still remember it, she looked at everybody and she said, oh, Barb's dad kicked the can. And I remember standing there going, yeah. Somebody else asked me if my dad died, and I said, yes, and they asked if I was sad, and I said, well, no, because they said he wouldn't have been all right had he lived anyway. I mean, just making excuses. It was just, I was floundering.
Yeah.
I remember setting the table for five one night, and my mother saying, now, Barbara, there are only four of us. Don't make that mistake again. She said, nothing is going to change. We'll still go on vacation. And my mom at that time, you know, she did the best that she could. But as far as tools, when we went to California, the tickets were purchased. And seating on airplanes was three and three at that time. Well, there were four of us, my mother, an older sister, a younger brother, and me. My mother, my brother, and my older sister sat together, and I had to sit by myself. And... It that's how life just evolved after that.
So what would the message be in the head of a 10-year-old, given the scenario? I mean, what does that leave you?
You are alone.
Hmm.
You are alone. And I didn't have a God anymore. I didn't have a baby Jesus or Jesus Christ, because I had begged and begged and begged that Dad would get better. If my daddy would get better, I would do this. I would do that. I would do this. And the minister at our church was, it was a Presbyterian church, and he was a very big man with a very deep voice and big pock marks all over his face. Scared the crap out of me. I mean, on a good day he did. On a good day. It was like,
this doesn't sound good.
Oh, no,
from
no.
The gate.
Oh, no. For no. It was like, now this big old, so forget God. There was not a God. There was no place safe, and I was alone.
So I guess those are your tools.
I became those were my tools.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you survive?
By the grace of, well, I can't say that because there wasn't a God. How did
that
I
comes
survive?
Later. We'll get there.
Yeah. Oh, it gets better. It gets so stinking better. My mom decided, my mom was born and raised in Oregon. She was the only person in her family that moved to the Midwest because she married my dad during the war. All of her family was in Oregon. All of her support systems were in Oregon. But my mother didn't want to move back to Oregon for who knows why. So we stayed in the Midwest, and my mom was busy raising Sharon and Bob, and I kind of just floundered along. Well, she decided that the best thing would be to get remarried. Oh, thank you, Jesus. And so she remarried the family dentist.
Hmm.
And if that is when the exposure to a really dysfunctional family unit began, that I would say I was probably 11 and a half years old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did it become more dysfunctional when he arrived? And the thought came to my head, is, well, at least you had good teeth. But
yes, I did, and I still do, and they're
still
all
do.
Mine.
I want to say, very nice teeth.
Thank you so much.
But,
I do appreciate that.
But so,
oh God,
say about the dysfunction part. What happened?
Emotionally abusive, not physically abusive. I do believe there was alcohol, but I never. He had every ism known to man.
Mm.
Control freak, absolute control freak. And, of course, he had children of his own. And, of course, we all got to live together just like the Brady Bunch on bad acid. it was, I mean, my stepsister's nickname, I called her Pork Chop, if that gives you a clue. My stepbrother was Pookie. Uh-huh. It was just...
Pork Chop and Pookie.
Oh, yeah. It was
okay.
Like... and this.
Did she have sideburns?
Pork chop. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, she was a short little fat thing.
Hmm.
My brother and my sister, these two other people, we all tried to live in this house, and it was just insane. It was insane. But and then my mother, her nickname was St. Helen. And so St. Helen was so worried about everybody and what they would think. I got the should stuff. You shouldn't do that. You should do this. You shouldn't do that. You should do this. You shouldn't feel like that. You shouldn't think like this. You shouldn't act like that. Rise above it. Rise above it, Barbara. You're bigger than that. You're stronger than that. And my mother was too busy working with my older sister and my younger brother. And when my stepfather would... have interactions with me. It was verbal and it was ugly. And we were like, I was a street fighter. And I held my ground, and my mom would stand in a corner with her little hands together and not say one word. Not say a word. Because she was too busy defending Bob or defending Sharon or defending Bob or defending Sharon.
So you're on your own still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I asked her as an adult, why she never intervened. And before her death, she told me that, well, but you were always so independent, Barbara. You didn't need anyone else. Ever since your father died. And it was like, Mommy, I was 10. You know, I was 10 years old. So essentially, I grew up on my own, by myself.
So do you make the connection between that whole package, that painting that you just very nicely put together for us here. Do you make a connection between that and what came later, your marriage and?
Oh yes, very strong connections. Yeah.
Okay.
Uh huh. Yeah. Very strong connection.
So tie it together a little bit for us. Well, maybe get us up to where you got married and you know. Or is that jumping too far ahead?
No, I did when I was 14. I tried to kill myself. When I was 14, I took a lot of. I was laying on the couch, and I thought it would be death by aspirin. I wasn't the brightest of the group, and I was lying there taking all this aspirin, thinking, "This is really stupid. Nobody'd really even miss me if I did die. So what's the point? I mean, you know, it's like, huh." So I stopped taking the aspirin, and I lived. Obviously, the connection.
Big stomach ache, probably. Mm.
No, I don't even remember a big stomach ache.
Nothing?
No.
That's pretty anticlimactic.
I know, it
That's
was very boring. I know. It was like, it was a really half-hearted attempt.
Yeah, yeah.
The connection By the time I graduated from high school, I just wanted to get out of that house, get away.
From Pookie and Pork Chop?
Oh, Pookie and Pork Chop and Louie and, I mean, the whole clan. It was like, just let me run. But I didn't realize how ill-prepared I was to live life. I went to college, and being away from home was, it was just like somebody let me out of prison, and it was a free-for-all. I mean, it was just, I had a good time. I used to refer to the college that I went to as the most expensive, what was it? It was like nightclub or, all I did was party. I partied and I played and I was free. And obviously that didn't last too long because I managed to be on academic probation the first semester and then flunked out the second semester. Yeah, it was stellar.
Yeah.
Some of those moves. Time fast forwarded, I floundered. Remember that flight to California when I was 10? The woman and man I sat next to, she was a Delta stewardess, and she had red lips and black hair, and she was the nicest person on the planet to me. And when I grew up, I wanted to be a stewardess. So I applied, and I was hired by an airline, and had gone back to college, dropped out of college, and I started flying. I met my first...
Did you fly for Delta?
No, for United.
Yeah.
I met my first husband during that one fun-filled year of partying at school.
Mm-hmm.
So it obviously didn't meet him in a library. good Lord. yeah. And he and I had all the dysfunction I needed and no tools, and I met an alcoholic whose family, his dad was an alcoholic. He was an alcoholic, but boy, he was so good looking and he was so popular and he was so sure of himself. And I just thought, wow, he likes me. He loves me. You know, this is, and all I wanted to do was be loved.
Yeah. Isn't that the way a codependent has a relationship?
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, he likes me.
So, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I get that.
You know, that
yeah.
I had no self-esteem.
Right.
I mean, I was a loser with a capital L. And I started flying. I was based out of New York. He was in school in Amsterdam. He came back. Our paths kept crossing. And so in my really disturbed 21-year-old mind, I thought, oh, it must be fate. Oh, yes. So, you know, we're always putting each other's path, and it must be him. So we ended up getting married. And all I wanted was married and a family. And I thought this was the love of my life. And yeah. And the drinking continued. And we had two children. And the pot smoking continued. And ironically, I could never really drink or smoke pot because I would fall asleep. It just was never my thing. And so his drinking continued. His pot smoking continued. His cocaine habit began and continued. And meanwhile, the children got older, two boys. He was from a very wealthy family, and which allowed him to have access to pot and cocaine, and we had a nice house, and everything looked good. Chocolate Easter Bunny syndrome looked great on the outside, and
hollow on the inside.
Yeah, he went to get He went to get the babysitter one day, and the next thing I got was a phone call that he was in jail for possession. Police had stopped him and smelled it and found it in his truck. So, yeah, it was years of therapy and marriage counseling and that wonderful intervention kind of thing that ended up with him telling me that, quote, you're just trying to change me. You won't accept me for who I am. And so I moved out with the kids. And thinking that, okay, being a single parent is going to be better than being married to an alcoholic who has a drug addiction and blah, blah, blah. Oh, that was a big, I was erroneous in that assumption. His cocaine ended up being a crack addiction. And I'm a single mom now of two teenage boys. And dad allowed them to smoke pot and have parties and have girls over so they could have sex at his house. And it was just an absolute nightmare. And
of course, that's where they probably wanted to be.
They wanted to live with me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then they wanted to be over there.
Mm-hmm.
He took them on vacation. And, he, of course, money, the DCFS, he was a fit parent as far as the state of Illinois was concerned. And I was the crazy one. And, of course, I was crazy at the time. I was trying to fix everything or control it or make sure everybody – I was nuts. But I didn't realize I was nuts. My first Al-Anon meeting came in at that time where I went and I
– And people would probably have a hard time understanding why this guy's, you know, letting the kids do whatever they want. He's a crackhead, and he's been busted for pot, and somehow or another – you're the crazy one. I mean, I understand that, how that could be, but how could you explain your brand of craziness so that the listening audience could understand that you could look crazier than that?
Well, because to others he didn't really look crazy. I mean, you know, he was a functioning alcoholic drug user. He mm-hmm. had plenty of money. There were attorneys to clean up after him all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am, the mom. When I left, he told me everybody knew I was crazy because how could I leave such a great situation? And from the outside, it looked like a great situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, upper middle class, you name it. Everything was good on the outside.
Right.
And my behavior was either manipulating or trying to crazy things like calling bars and seeing if he could come home. I think back now and it's like, what was I doing? What was I trying to do?
Mm-hmm.
So it continued on a downhill spiral. And there were no boundaries. There were no limits. It was a battle with the kids. I was trying to save my children. And I was on a first-name basis with the police department in a couple of different towns. I finally decided...
Why? Because they were getting in trouble? Or because you were trying to track them down? Or what was the...
They were getting in trouble.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. They were getting in trouble. And...
Were you trying to keep them out of trouble?
Oh, I was trying to keep them out of trouble. was I trying to keep them out of trouble? It didn't really work. And it's funny when I reflect on that time or try to think back, it's like everything is just all mixed together. There were so many times that it was, when is the other shoe going to drop? You know, there was never any calm. It was like, okay, I was at home with the boys, and they would have kids over, and there would be a case of beer, and I would find the case of beer. I would confiscate it, and then they would find where I confiscated it, and I'd go back, and it was a case of empty beer cans. Or my son borrowed the car one night to take somebody home, and the next thing I know, somebody's knocking on the door because he totaled the car that had 500 miles on it around a tree.
Mm.
It just went on and on and on. And then the crazy ex-husband is running around like a maniac with the girlfriends and with my sons and doing things that were really not appropriate for that age group, like taking them to Jamaica so they could be introduced to the Rastafarian culture by getting stoned on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a family vacation.
Yaman.
Yaman. moved. I transferred with my job, and I took my two children to Texas to get them out and away. And geographical moves don't work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Geographical cures, yeah.
It didn't work.
It was a good try.
It was. It was good. I remember talking.
They didn't spontaneously get well?
No, they didn't. No. As a matter of fact, they decided, the oldest one was at the end of his junior year, and he decided that he was going to come back and stay with Dad, and he did. And the youngest one stayed with me for another year, and then he decided that he wanted to come up north and have a relationship with his dad. And he did. And to make a long story short, the youngest one ended up being kidnapped by two men from California and taken to Utah to go to a camp, a rehab situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because one Christmas he was telling me of all the drugs that he had done, and he thought it was perfectly normal to sit and have a conversation with Mom when you're 15 and list all these drugs that you've done, and Mom's going to say, oh, goody, have a nice year. It didn't happen that way. The oldest one, and by now the dad is still out, and he's involved with all kinds of, he's selling and drugs and the FBI and sniffy dogs, they were involved. And I mean, it was just getting better and better. And I'm being a long-distance mom on the phone from Texas. And he ended up in jail. He finally ended up in jail. And he ended up in rehab. And the boys, by now, they had, you know, fast forward a few years. And they had made some decisions and choices. And I was still trying at that point to help them, to be there, to parent them.
And how old were they? About 18? 17, 18?
Oh, 18 and like 21.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the youngest one who I had kidnapped.
You don't give up easy, do you?
Oh, it took me another 10 years. Yeah.
You know what? I think what we'll do, let's take a break.
Oh, sure.
Because let's take a short break. We're going to play, what are we going to play? We're going to play, what do you got, Chris?
Track by George Harrison called My Sweet Lord.
Okay, good. We'll do that, and then we'll come back. We'll pick up about there, and then, you know, see where that took you, and then hopefully we'll get to talk a little bit about the recovery end of things and how things have come together for you.
Yeah.
All the way from Easter Bunny to where we are today.
Perfect.
Easter Bunny till now.
All right, good deal. Let's do it.
Straight from 1970. This is George Harrison. We'll be back with you in about 5 minutes. Thanks for listening.
1970? Did you really say that?
thanks for joining us tonight. Welcome back to Recovery Internet Radio. We've been having quite the discussion so far. Hope you enjoy the music. What's the tag of our show again here, just if people are just joining us?
Meet the Amazing Chocolate Easter Bunny.
Ooh.
What do you think?
What do you think about that?
Yeah, okay. Right. So let's pick up a little kind of where we left off a bit, but I just wanted to ask a quick question, and that is, do you still feel the same hollowness today that you did then?
No. Oh, no. No, no, no. Not at all.
Yeah. Hmm. That's good. And that's, you know, so I think what people would be interested in is, how did you get from hollow and, you know, all of the stuff, the control, the management, the craziness, how did we get from there to here? Because you seem pretty happy.
I am.
And you were riding a horse today.
I was riding a horse. How did I get from there to here?
Yeah.
My oldest son was 27 years old. So for 27 years plus whatever, I spent trying to make everybody else's life wonderful, trying to please everybody so things were good for them. Because if things were good for other people, then things would be good for me and they'd like me.
Hmm.
Talk about screwed up thinking.
But you didn't know it then.
Oh, I had no idea. It was like the more I did, the worse it got. And it's like, if they just listened to me, you know, if they would just do this, if he would stop drinking, or if he would stop doing drugs, or if he would go to this college, or if he would just blah, 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 everything would be fine. Everything would be fine. And meanwhile, I was consumed with the lives of my two sons at that point. And one day, my sister called me because my ex husband, who now is clean and sober, had called her because my 27-year-old son had been drinking. What a surprise. And it was around St. Patrick's Day, and he had been excessively drinking, which is the only way he drinks, and had walked in front of a car that was going 45 miles an hour at a very, very busy intersection in one of the western suburbs. And he was in the hospital, and ex-husband called her for some reason to tell her about Adam. Oops. And she called me, and she told me, and this accident had happened 3 days earlier.
Why didn't he just call you? Or you weren't speaking?
Oh, no, I was who? The ex-husband?
Yeah.
I had an attorney on retainer for 11 years trying to deal with the ex-husband because he was, I couldn't talk to him. I could not talk to him. He went through a couple wives, and there was crack, and there were pimps, and there was somebody in some apartment somewhere, his mistress that he, I mean, it just went on and on and on. So he had to go through the attorney to talk to me. Oh. It was that bad.
Yeah.
And, he called to make amends to me, the ex-husband. And when he called me to make amends, I said, well, what amends are you making? And he said, well, you should know you were there. Derp. so we didn't have a real good communication, line of communication.
Is that where the amends ended?
That was where the amends ended.
Oh.
That I should know because I was there.
Hmm.
And anyway, back to the 27-year-old. And when I found out about the accident, the first thing I wanted to know was he alive? And yes, he was alive. Then I called his younger brother and asked his younger brother why, because by now they're all in their 20s somewhere, why no one called me, why he didn't call me. And he said he was too upset. And something snapped. Something broke in me. It was, I just can't do this anymore. I cannot do this anymore. And at the time, I worked for an airline, and I was flying international. And I was I was based out of Chicago because in my twisted little mind, I thought if I was based in Chicago, even though I lived in Texas, I could see my children more often. So I commuted to Chicago from Texas.
Because this is where they lived.
Oh, yeah, this is where they lived, yeah. And I lived in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So I came up because I had a trip to fly, and I went over to see my 27-year-old son, who now it's like day 4 or 5 after the accident, and his head was still the size of a balloon and bruised, and he blew out the knee that had been replaced from a blah, blah, blah. And I went into his home, and he looked at me and started to make a joke, and I said to him, the only thing I want you to do is put into writing how you want buried, because this is going to happen again. And when it does, and you die, I don't want to be arguing with your father over where you're going to be buried and how. And I left. And that is the last time that I said anything about his drinking. It was like I was done. My two sons are and were the most important things in my life. They were my family. They are my family. But I cannot live their lives. I cannot make their decisions. And I was so desperate and so broken at that time. I went into an Al-Anon meeting in Texas. And I just sat there because the chocolate Easter bunny was melting. And there was going to be nothing at all left. And not only was I hollow, I was done. I was just done. I could not tell anybody my favorite color, my favorite food, what kind of movies I liked. I didn't like to do anything because I'd been so consumed with doing, being a human doing things for others to try to clean up their messes that I didn't even
know who you were.
I had no idea who I was. Yeah. None whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there's the hollow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you started in, you started going to Al-Anon. How did that help you?
I found out I was not alone.
Mm-hmm.
I would sit in Al-Anon meetings, and I didn't want to be there, but I didn't know where else to be. And I would sit and I would listen to these people, men and women, talk, and they would describe things that were happening or had happened that had happened to me too.
Hmm.
And I wasn't the only, I learned I wasn't the only person on the planet that some horrific things had happened to, and that people were actually, that people lived, not only lived through them, they lived through them, they grew, they laughed, they were relaxed, they had fun.
Hmm.
They had friends. It was okay to ask for help because up until then, it was not okay to ask for help for me. Hmm. I should have been able to do everything on my own. That was ingrained in my head somewhere.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of your tools.
Oh, yeah. That was one of my tools. I can handle this. I can take care
right.
of
yeah,
it.
I'm alone.
I'm strong.
I'm on my own.
I am. I'm on my own.
Right.
And the whole higher power thing.
Right.
When I first went into Al-Anon, I thought, and that was a tough one for me. The higher power, it's like, what are you talking about?
Right,
never been anybody there, yeah. And it's like, you think there's going to be somebody there now? Half that chance. And so my higher power was Mr. Potato Head. That is who. Yeah, I thought, Mr. Potato Head, that'll work. I can turn Mr. Potato Head into anything I want him to be or her to be. And that's where my, because I was told your higher power can be anything.
Mm-hmm.
I was told it could be a spaceship. It could be, you know, I'm thinking, oh, okay, Mr. Potato Head wins.
And you can dress him up different every day.
You can. He can have one eye. He can have two eyes. You know, he can have it all. Mm-hmm. And throughout my house now, I have Mr. Potato Heads all over the place. It's amazing how many they make. I have the entire collection of the Wizard of Oz.
Really?
Yeah, Potato Heads.
Do you do Legos too? Just curious.
As a matter of fact, I'm a full-fledged card member to Legoland.
Really?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
I'm just, saying. So the light, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, is there a time when you would say the light came on for you? Was that was that when you told your son to write that letter, or was that when you realized you weren't alone, or is the rheostat turning the light up gradually?
I was on a dimmer switch.
Dimmer switch.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's
of came on gradually.
Okay.
Very gradually. And listening to other people talk, trying to figure out who I was and what I liked, and that taking care of myself, doing things for me was not selfish. Making time for myself or going was not selfish. That was normal.
Mm-hmm.
That was being normal. I'd never been normal.
Mm.
I was always, you have to do something for other people, or you. Yeah, it was crazy thinking.
And what were your kids doing at this time? Did they know that you were doing what you needed to do to get well here, or did they not know?
I don't know if they really cared, quite honestly. Did they know? They knew I was different.
Yeah.
Yeah. The phone calls, the suggestions, why don't you try this? Oh, here, try this. Oh, here, I'll fix that. Oh, here, you need some money? Oh, you want to... My children thought that, or one of them in particular, thought that American Airlines was like Greyhound bus. They flew, because I worked for them, and they flew all over the country, and it was... flew back and forth. It was crazy. I couldn't say no.
Hmm.
And I stopped doing things. I just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And was taking care of myself. And so there were quite a period of time. We would always talk, and I would fly up and see them. But it was different than it had been.
Yeah. Did you feel, had you felt happiness yet?
Had I felt happiness yet? That was a long time coming.
Hmm.
That was a long time coming. I loved my job because I could always, I was always gone. I mean, it was like I was always gone and going to different places, loved traveling. But I found my job less than fulfilling. And one of the things that I'd always wanted to do and felt less than about was I wanted to finish school, finish college.
Mm-hmm.
I had had an associate degree from a junior college and decided that I wanted to go back and finish the degree. So when I was in Texas, I went back for myself and finished the degree. And while I was in school, one of the deans took me under her wing and encouraged me to go on and get a graduate degree. And so I thought, oh, okay. And I did. And it was during this time between going to meetings, taking care of myself, talking a lot with people that were in Al-Anon, having my sponsor, growing and accomplishing these, whether it was a course or whether it was doing a presentation, it was a very gradual thing, building self-esteem.
Mm-hmm. You were really putting it together one piece at a time, weren't you?
Oh, I was.
Yeah.
Very much.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh, very much. And still, I still do. I mean, but I digress. Back then and going one step at a time and I was always fear, you know, am I going to be good enough? Am I smart enough? Am I this enough? And all of those things came into play. And gradually, bit by bit, I felt lighter. I didn't feel so empty. I'd look in a mirror and I'd like me. You know, it's I liked myself, and I never really had liked myself.
Mm.
Because I based what I thought of myself on what other people thought of me. And did not think about what I thought of myself. I sought from others approval. I sought from others, you did a great job, Barb. I never had the self-esteem to pat myself on the back.
And did you end up getting a nursing degree? Yeah, you're a nurse, aren't you?
My associate degree was in nursing, then I had a bachelor's in nursing, then I got a master's in nursing education.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And became a teacher, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's all since Al-Anon.
It's quite a journey.
It has been. It has been quite a journey.
How do you explain that to somebody? Like if you were talking to somebody now, like you were then, how can you explain to them that this, could you get them to believe that this could really happen for them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Could you do it? How would you do it?
They're not alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not alone. Can I get them to believe? No, I can't make anybody do anything. I mean, just, I'm sure that people, and to this day, you know, people look at me and would have absolutely no idea of what I've been through.
Yeah.
None. You know, it's like, and to me, that was just normal. Somebody who is, can it happen? You have to be open. You have to believe. You have to believe. You can't give up hope that there's something better.
You never did? You never did give up hope?
No. No. And I don't even think I realized it was hope at the time. I just knew that there had to be something better than what I was living. There mm-hmm. had to be. Because whether it was little girl.
Because what it was really sucked.
Yeah, what it was really sucked. I mean, it just really wasn't any fun at all.
Right.
And it had to be better than that. So.
And plus, you were around other Al-Anon people who I assume you saw making changes and getting better and doing things. And
I would hear their stories and I would look at them in just awe. I mean, it was like that happened to you because they were laughing and they were honest and they were fun and caring and nothing is more when I'm in a room with Al-Anon people, there is a presence there that is just, I can feel it. I mean, it's my higher